Hey, this is WTOP's Jason Fraley, and we are being joined by, just say your name and your title.
I'm Aaron Posner, and I'm the director, co-director, and co-adapter of The Tempest at Roundhouse Theater.
Yes, it's going to be at Roundhouse Theater from November 23rd through January 1st, The Tempest. Hey, thanks for joining us, Aaron.
Sure, my pleasure.
All right, so before we get into the show, is this, it's not a co-production with Folger Shakespeare Library, is it? Or is it like a co-production?
It's a collaborative production. They're both, Roundhouse has been taking the lead, but the Folger is deeply part of it as well. So it is, and I have a long history with both Roundhouse and Folger, and so it's great to have both teams working to make this thing happen, because it's a big one.
Right. I just wanted to make sure I had that right for my purposes, so I tee it up properly. So, okay, so Roundhouse Theater is the, you know, the main theater putting it on. So Folger Theaters, what are they contributing?
I'm not even sure of all the details. It is, okay. Both audiences are coming to see it. The Folger has been supportive of the whole production process. It's a team, but I don't know the exact details of the team. Again, it's a lot of people. This is one that takes all hands on deck for this show.
Awesome. And yes, all hands on deck, because tell us about the very famous person that you are co-directing it with.
Well, it's an honor and a privilege to work with my friend Teller of Penn and Teller. We've worked on this show together before. We've worked on a couple other Shakespeare productions before. I had the honor to meet him back in the 90s and found that the silent member of Penn and Teller is also a Shakespeare fanatic who can quote long sections of Macbeth and The Tempest and Midsummer and Hamlet and various plays. He knows his Shakespeare backwards and forwards. And I was very lucky to be a person who met him at a time that he was like, I want to do Shakespeare, not I want to be in it. And I'm not a theater director, but I want to conceive productions and weave magic into them the way that he thought Shakespeare had envisioned. And so that began a multi-decades process of us doing some Shakespeare together.
Wow. Who would have thought that, as you put it, the silent member of Penn and Teller had all those great verbose Shakespeare monologues in his brain. He just
Absolutely.
Wasn't really saying it on stage. All right. Well, we always associate Penn and Teller with, you know, magic shows, of course, sleight of hand, etc. But talk about how that fuses its way into The Tempest here. You know, is there like you can sort of tell from the logo, there's, you know, deck of cards flying around with the Tempest
and
logo.
And there's decks of cards flying around on stage too. I mean, this is Shakespeare's most magical show for sure. There are others that involve magic, but Prospero, the central character, is a magician shipwrecked on a desert island. We have sort of nicknamed this show a shipwrecked magic show. And those influences are powerfully at work in this piece. Prospero is a magician. And very often in productions of The Tempest, they use that sort of magical power as metaphor for this was Shakespeare's last play. So it's for him saying goodbye to his art as a literary person. It's about science. It's about technology. It's about variety of things. We decided that we would think of Prospero, the magician, as a magician and have and do on stage what Prospero is doing to the characters in the play, which is astonishing them, astounding them, knocking them off their game and out of their senses by astonishing feats of magic and mystery. So in this production, we have woven 20-something magic tricks, magic effects, magic moments deeply into the fabric of the story. So Prospero is messing with a bunch of people who show up on his island without saying too much. And we use music, we use magic to put those people in the mindset that he wants them to be in, which is astonish, astound, and eventually totally befuddled.
Wow. And now, what kind of magic show? You said 20 some magic tricks, and obviously we don't want to spoil any of them, but is there a general way to at least give me a couple anecdotes?
All the things you can do on stage. You do stage magic. There are certain limitations, but yet, is it sort of close up magic and sleight of hand? Yes. Is it larger magical effects? Yes. It is what makes the magic unique in this production is that usually you go see a magic show and you do a magic trick and everyone goes, oh, wow, that was a really great magic trick. I didn't see that card get there. I didn't know that could move to that location or whatever it is. But it has beauty. It has skill, but it often doesn't have meaning. But in this production, because it's woven into the narrative, when we do a magic trick, I'll tell you one. There is a magic trick that is called a twister box. That's all I'll say about it. Some people will know what that means. But Prospero, when he is describing to Ariel, his magical servant, why he needs to do what he has been asked to do, he reminds him that he was once imprisoned in a pine tree and that Prospero let him out. But rather than just tell him that story, Prospero imprisons him in a sort of metaphorical pine tree and reminds him of how uncomfortable and twisty it was locked in that pine tree. So we take a hundreds-year-old magic trick and we put it in service to the narrative that Shakespeare wrote. And so, and when that really works, the story is made clearer, you hear it in ways you never had, and you watch an amazing magic trick accumulate meaning and engagement. And we do the same thing with the music in the production as well, because we've woven a dozen Tom Waits tunes into this production as well. So there's musically also we're saying we're making the story richer by weaving in these additional elements.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, well, you mentioned Tom Waits, so let's go there really quick. How did he get involved? I mean, how did you get his music? I mean, that's kind of a big deal.
It was, you know, when Tyler and I first began talking about this, he brought to the table a guy named, not literally to the table because he was quite dead, Willard the Wizard, who was a traveling tent show magician in the early part of the 20th century, traveling around mostly the Southwest, performing off the back of a flatbed truck, doing these astonishing tricks. And there was something about the traveling tent show, magic show, that felt very much like a little island contained within itself. He traveled with his daughter, and Miranda, Prospero's daughter, plays a prominent role in this production. So we took a lot of inspiration from Willard the Wizard. And once we were in this sort of dust bowl, crappy, beaten up, hard traveled Southern American energy for the play, if you're going to go to one composer to fulfill that world, it's going to be Tom Waits.
And that gravelly, dark voice.
That's right, you know, that world for it. And Teller had worked with Tom on a production called Frank's Wild Years back at Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago in the early 80s. So Teller, as he will, just called up Tom Waits and said, "Hey, we have this idea. You want to meet about it?" And so we met with Tom in Las Vegas. And had a couple of meetings and talked about how we might, there was a whole lot of ideas on the table, but what we finally ended up with was Tom saying this, he thought this sounded awesome. He wasn't sure how he didn't want to write a new musical, but he said, "This sounds great, go for it. And you can use anything of mine I own," which was anything after 1983. And so for a year or two, I listened to a lot of Tom Waits music as we figured out, because so much of the texture of that music fit the sort of messed up, rough, raw, sort of, you know, difficult and dangerous world that we were creating. So we ended up incorporating a bunch of Tom Waits tunes into the fabric of the show. Again, it's not a musical. People don't sing, "Oh, I like you, I want to do whatever." Like, they don't sing.
Jackie Fuller Bourbon, the musical.
Yeah, they don't move the story forward with song, but it fulfills the texture of the world.
Right.
And we originally had Shana Taub, who's now gone on to great fame writing for Broadway, as our original musical director and arranger. And now we have the fabulous Liz Filios, who's helped arrange. We have four musicians on stage, singers and percussionists, playing messed up percussion instruments in a very Waitsy and vain. So it's got an amazing sort of texture of the world that adds to the magic, that adds to the Shakespeare, and that makes, and Shakespeare wrote The Tempest as a very musical play. There's music written into it. So we just sort of, even though we're going in odd and unique directions, we were trying to fulfill his vision.
Well, I just jokingly mentioned Jackie Fuller Bourbon, but could you name drop a couple songs that we might hear?
Oh, Dirt in the Ground is in there. Shiny Things. You're Innocent When You Dream. There's some, you know, they are odd and complicated. And again, they were ones that add texture, that bring us into a world that is painful and beautiful. Because if you go, other than a lot of food and pets that tend to be in Tom's songs, there's a lot of beauty and there's a lot of brokenness. And that is exactly the tenor of this Tempest as well. A lot, very beautiful, very broken, very complicated, and in the end, very redemptive. And that all sounds like Tom Waits to me.
Oh man, I mean that Tom Waits can he can literally do anything in any medium. I mean, we mentioned all the music, but then I mean he could act like those Jim Jarmusch films, like Down by Law, and I think he was in Coffee and Cigarettes. Like he could do all of that, and then now the theater. So he's showing the other side. You know what I mean?
He's been writing for the theater for years. He wrote with Robert Wilson, Dark Rider, and a couple other pieces. So he and his wife Kathleen Brennan, who he wrote this music with, they are amazing. Their theatrical sensibility is crazy. One of the things during this whole process that we would say WWTWD was one of our little codes as we would work on the show. It would be, you know, what would Tom Waits do every time we would get to a little problem in design or a moment and go like, oh, Tom Waits is sort of our spirit guide on this whole production.
The spirit guide. I love it. I'm going to, if you forgive me for one bad pun tangent, but I've always envisioned you're a theater guy. You'll hopefully appreciate this corniness. I've always envisioned a two person, no dialogue, one central setting theater act with Tom Waits and Jeremy Irons. And Jeremy Irons is at the ironing board and Tom Waits is looking at his watch. And that's the whole thing. Tom Waits while Jeremy Irons.
I like it. It's kind of a take on Waiting for Godot.
Yeah, exactly.
Waiting for ironing. I think that's
they don't even need to say anything because Teller is silent, you know. All right. Anyway, that's the best I can bring it back around. So, all right. So, we've mentioned a lot that this was Shakespeare's one of his most magical plays. But so maybe we're taking for granted that you and I know what it's about, but maybe some of our listeners don't know the exact premise. So tell us who this sorcerer Prospero is. You know what I mean? Like, give me the basic
to not spoil it for people who don't know it or who only read it in high school and never quite finished it or never loved it that much, which is, you know, Teller talks a lot about giving people Shakespeare to read in high school is like handing someone a Beethoven score and saying, isn't this great? Look at all those notes. Those are so good. You know, Shakespeare is not meant to be read. I mean, it's great to read, but it's meant to be seen and it's meant to be brought to life by amazing actors. And we have an incredible cast here led by Eric Hissom as Prospero, the Duke of Milan. So it's about a man who, when he was the Duke of Milan, he was a magician. He wasn't a great duke always because he was so fascinated by his magic. He owns that. So his brother tosses him out of the kingdom and takes over. And this is the premise that starts the play off. And so he puts his brother, Prospero, and Prospero's three-year-old daughter, Miranda, out to sea, potentially to die. And that is, and we pick it up 12 years later on a very special day. That the whole play takes place on this one day on Prospero's Island. And that's all I really want to say. It's a pretty straightforward play in some ways. It can be, at times can be a little hard to follow who these people are. We've made it really, really clear. And really, I think the storytelling is really strong, even though we've woven in all these other elements. There's Prospero on the island with his daughter and a couple of inhabitants of the island. And then there's there's some people who show up, you know, as visitors on this one day, and it's what happens what ensues between them all. One of the elements I haven't mentioned, which is a big part of this production too, is as if Tom Waits and Teller wasn't enough.
There's
more. Order today. On the island is this called a creature or monster, Caliban, who is said to be an inhabitant of the island left there by his mother Sycorax. And it's always an interesting puzzle of how you bring to life a creature that is not quite human or is other than human. And people have done it in a wide variety of often very creative ways over the years.
Is it like half a human, half a monster, Caliban?
That is one of the exact lines. Yes, half a human, half a monster. So what do you do with that? Well, as we were working on this, Penn and Teller were also working with the incredible modern dance company Palabolas on a piece that they were actually creating, that they were collaborating on. And Teller, while watching their work one day, as he will, went suddenly, wait a second, I see a Caliban in there. And so we met with Palabolas and came up with this idea of a kind of conjoined twin two-person Caliban moving in remarkable, Palabolas sort of weight sharing, defying gravity ways. And so we proposed this to Palabolas. They got excited. We've had Matt Kent and Renee Jaworski, the artistic directors of Palabolas, with us as we've been working. And we have these Hasia Muhammad and Ryan Sellers are our two-person Caliban who performed the role in total tandem. And it is yet another element that sort of brings out the unearthliness of the piece. Along with, you know, I have to just mention too, Nate Dendy, who's our magic consultant, who was playing Ariel and has been playing Ariel since Teller and I first started working on this production almost a decade ago. Nate is an amazing sleight of hand magician. So this is where, you know, a lot of the actors in the production are actors, but Nate is both a remarkable actor and a remarkable magician. So we have a lot of things woven into the fabric of this production between the music and the magic and the movement. And of course, Shakespeare, some of Shakespeare's most gorgeous language. The famous thing of we are such stuff as dreams are made on is from The Tempest. And there's other just remarkable moments of poetry and sort of broken humanity through the language as well. So yeah, it's quite a thing. We're very proud of it. We've been working incredibly hard on it, and we're super proud to share it.
I'm glad that you mentioned the beautiful, famous language and the famous lines. Like, you know, you mentioned we are such stuff as dreams are made on. I mean, you wouldn't have the Bogart Maltese Falcon line without that, probably, the stuff that dreams are made of. You know, it probably all dates back to Shakespeare, if our little life rounded out with sleep. Oh, and even probably even the most famous What's Past is Prologue, right?
Yeah, everyone. Absolutely. Another of my favorite, I mean, a line I've quoted a lot, which I think is super true. No, Shakespeare is, you don't realize the depth of which Shakespeare, you know, like, we jokingly will talk about, Prospero stole the character of Ariel from Mr. Spock on Star Trek. But of course, it's the opposite. You know, like, Ariel is not quite human and doesn't quite understand human emotion. And it is exactly the model for Spock, because taking someone who is quite kind of human, but removing one element is what, you know, science fiction and fantasy have been doing for years. And so you see it embedded there. All through this play, you see... there's so much in Shakespeare, all of Shakespeare's plays, but you see so much that people have borrowed and have become part of our cultural fabric through Shakespeare. So to see it in the original and the way that these ideas and these tropes have sort of woven themselves into all of popular culture is, here's when you talk about what the play is finally about. Even more importantly, maybe, than all the other stuff I've talked about, you know, Teller and I are both populists, and we love Shakespeare that scholars will enjoy, and that's awesome, and more power to him. But whether you're coming because it's Teller or it's Tom Waits or it's Palabolas or it's Shakespeare, or for whatever reason, we are both passionate about making Shakespeare that is available and accessible to everyone. So I do hope that people won't let the Shakespeare of it keep them away if that's not their thing, because the story is so amazing. But after all is said and done, after you take with all of the magic and all of the music and all of the movement at its most basic level, this is a story about redemption and about connection and about the difficult things that happened in families and the consequences of actions and about familial love. It comes down to a really remarkable story about the nature of forgiveness and humanity. There's another of the famous lines, the rarer action is in virtue than in vengeance. And as we've been working on this play at this time, I have to say, for all the bells and whistles, it's getting back to that story and talking about the incredible power and the redemptive power of forgiveness and of love and of humanity that is sits at the core of why we're doing all the things we're doing.
Wow, so beautifully put. And those themes are going to be powerful for everyone, whether they think they're into Shakespeare or not. So I'm glad that you mentioned sort of the accessibility of you know, like, what is your analogy? Handing a Beethoven manuscript to someone that's listening to Drake or whatever. Yeah, it's not. So talk about, let's end there. Like, is sort of the goal, is the idea of, you know, bringing in Teller and magic and Tom Waits and all, and Parabola, like, is sort of the idea of this to, you know, maybe make a bigger umbrella and invite some other people in that think they might not be into Shakespeare. And then maybe they'll walk out of the Tempest and say, oh my God, I love Shakespeare.
I love creating Shakespeare for the Shakespeare lovers. That's awesome. But I also call, I really love to create Shakespeare for the people that I call the husbands. And of course, the husbands don't need to be male. They don't need to be husbands.
Right.
But those who are maybe
tag-along quite the passionate, spouses,
the ones that are coming because they love their person that they're coming with, and they will are willing to come see this play, even though they would rather be doing X, Y, or Z. But right. I want them to go, oh my God, this has got something for me. This is, and it's not, and I don't mean the other stuff. That stuff is to create pathways into what Shakespeare has so brilliantly created, the depth of character, the beauty of language. You know, Shakespeare, like it or not, Shakespeare is held up there as Shakespeare, as this thing. And it doesn't need to sit on a mountaintop or a pedestal. Shakespeare can be, it was for everyone. It has been for the last 400 years designed to be for everyone. And it can be for everyone. And we, you know, in the casting of this show, in the tenor and the energy of the show, we are trying to make as big a tent as possible and welcome as many people as possible into it.
Yep. And because, to your point, Shakespeare in his day was a populist. These were the popular shows. So there's no need for it not to be popular and appeal to the mass audience today while still appealing to the hardcore Shakespeare fans.
Absolutely. That is our goal.
And I guess the way I want to we're sort of talking about his role and his career and trajectory and all that stuff. Like, I would love to end with your thoughts on where this sort of falls in Shakespeare's, you know, his whole trajectory as an artist, because I know it was towards the very end of it. You know, he did all those great comedies, all those great tragedies. Do you sort of view The Tempest as sort of this fantastical, almost magical realist culmination? Like, is it like a crescendo of his career, or how do you view it in terms of bibliography?
Jason, I absolutely do. I think I've spent a lot of time on this play over the years. I directed it for the first time in the early 90s. I have spent a lot of time living in the structure and the bones and the DNA of this play. And what is amazing about it is that it brings it all together. It's genuinely funny. It has, you know, deep humanity and the sort of it's ridiculously silly. There are moments in this play and in our production, particularly in the hands of our clowns, Richard Henry and Kate Norris, that are like, it's ridiculous. It is kind of stupid in the most delightful way. And it can contain that energy, and that's woven through all of Shakespeare's comedies, right? You have a loving absurdity of human behavior at its most elemental and ridiculous, playing with the audience, improvising, making things up, enjoying how silly human beings can be. But the next moment, you go into sort of the depth of darkness, of humanity, of loss. He wrote pageantry into it and song. And again, by adding all this stuff, this wasn't us taking we didn't try and add a bunch of music and magic to Coriolanus or to Pericles or to sort of more harder other worlds that didn't ask for it. Shakespeare wrote a mask, a pageant into the middle of this play. And so we fulfill that very much in our own way. But yeah, he brought together total drama, complete romance, ridiculous comedy. And we are trying to respect all of those. But yeah, this is him at the height of his powers. I do think I've been doing this for a while now. Kelly's been doing it for a very long time. I think we would like to hope that people get better and better and you're able to keep more balls in the air. It's a little bit like the great sitcoms, whatever one thinks is the great sitcoms of your generation. Like for me, it was MASH and All in the Family growing up.
For me, it was Seinfeld.
Yeah, exactly. That where you can have ridiculousness next to genuine moments of humanity and of passion and of kindness, and then music, you can go to a lot of places. And by this point in Shakespeare's career, he was able to take us to a lot of places, and that's what we're trying to do here.
Wow, perfectly said. The deliriously stupid to the deceptively profound.
There it is, exactly.
I love it. Well, and with a little magic and Tom Waits. I love it.
And a ton of magic and a lot of Tom Waits.
Ton of magic and a lot of Tom Waits. I love it. Well, I'm all jacked up. This is so cool. Again, everyone, it is The Tempest, the classic tale, magically reimagined at Roundhouse Theater with a slight assist from Folger Library, but mostly here at Roundhouse. It's going to run November 23rd to January 1st at Roundhouse in Bethesda. So get your tickets now. Aaron, thanks so much for doing this. This sounds awesome.
Jason, I think it's, you know, we have a great group and we're having a great time, and I think people will enjoy coming to see it. So I hope they do.
All right. Well, be well. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you soon and hope, we'll try to invite all our listeners to head on out there. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.